Human book. Which book? Ah, thank you, myself. Jane's Survey of Basic Galactic Tools, one of the rarest surviving fruits of the great printing. Exactly as depicted in that ancient diagram, this floating mechanism was a black octagonal slab about the size of a young Kewin, hovering above the ground at about the level of my ring of vision, with various gleaming implements projecting above or hanging below. From the moment the hatch closed behind it, the robot ignored every earthly contour, leaving a trail where grass, pebbles, and loam were pressed flat by unseen heaviness. Wherever it approached, folk quailed back. Just one group of beings kept still, awaiting the creature of not flesh, we sages. Responsibility was our cruel mooring, so adamant that even my basal segment stayed rigid, though it pulsed with craven need to flee. The robot, or its masters in the ship, thus knew who had the right duty to parley. It hesitated in front of Vubbin, appearing to contemplate our eldest sage for 5 or 6 duras, perhaps sensing the reverence we all hold for the wisest of the Gekek. Then it backed away to confront us all. We watched in mystified awe. After all, this was a thing, like a Hoonish riverboat or some dead tool left by the vanished boyer. Only the tools we make do not fly, and boyer remnants show no further interest in doing so. This thing not only moved, it spoke, commencing first with a repeat of the earlier message. Surveying local unique life forms, in this we seek your gracious help. Knowledge of the local biosphere, this you assuredly have. Tools and useful arts, these we offer in trade. Confidentially, shall we mutually exchange? Our rauk were useless, shriveling away from the intense flux of our distress. We sages nonetheless held conference. By agreement, Vubbin rolled forward, his roller wheels squeaking with age. In a show of discipline, all eye stalks turned toward the alien device, though surely over-surfeited with its frightening stimulus. "Poor castaways are we," he commenced reciting, in the syncopated pops and clicks of formal Galactic II. Although our Urish cousins find that language easiest and use it among themselves, all conceded that Vubbin the Gekek was peerless in his mastery of the grammar, especially when it came to telling necessary lies. "Poor castaways, ignorant and stranded, delighted are we, ecstatic at this wondrous thing, advent of rescue."
Sarah.
Some distance below Dolo Village, the river felt its way through a great marsh, where even Hoon sailors were known to lose the main channel, snagging on tree roots or coming aground on shifting sandbars. Normally, the brawny, patient crew of the dross hauler Haufwawa would count on wind and the river's rhythmic rise and fall to help them slip free. But these weren't normal times, so they folded their green cloaks, revealing anxious mottles across their lumpy backbone ridges, and pushed the Haufwawa along with poles made of lesser boo. Even passengers had to assist now and then to keep the muddy bottom from seizing the keel and holding them fast. The uneasy mood affected the ship's contingent of flighty Nuer, who barked nervously, scampering across the masts, missing commands and dropping lines. Finally, just before nightfall, the captain pilot guided the Haufwawa's ornate prow past one last fen of droopy tall grass to Unity Point, where the river's branches reconverged into an even mightier whole. The Garou forest resumed, spreading a welcome sheltering canopy over both banks. After such an arduous day, the air seemed all at once to release passengers and crew from its moist clench. A cool breeze stroked skin, scale, and hide, while sleek Nuer sprang overboard to splash alongside the gently gliding hull, then clambered the masts and spars to stretch and preen. Sarah thanked Pretty when her assistant brought supper in a wooden bowl. Then the chimp took her own meal to the side in order to flick overboard the spicy greens that Hoon chefs loved slicing into nearly everything they cooked. A trail of bubbles showed that river creatures feeding on the scraps weren't so finicky. Sarah didn't mind the tangy taste, though most earthlings wound up defecating bright colors after too many days of shipboard fare. When Pretty later brought a pair of blankets, Sarah chose the plushest to tuck over the stranger, sleeping near the main hold with its neatly stacked crates of dross. His brow bore a sheen of perspiration, which she wiped with a dry cloth. Since early yesterday, he had shown none of the lucidity so briefly displayed when the ill-omened bolide split the sky. Sarah had misgivings about hauling the wounded man on a hurried, stressful trek. Still, there was a good clinic in Tarrick Town, and this way she might keep an eye on him while performing her other duty, one rudely dropped into her lap last night, after that frenzied conclave in the meeting tree. Pizora stood nearby, a dark tower, dormant but ever vigilant over the patient's condition. The pharmacist vented steamy puffs from the specialized ring that routinely performed ad hoc chemistry beyond the understanding of Gijo's best scholars or even the Treiki themselves. Wrapping her shoulders in another soft gekek-spun blanket, Sarah turned and watched her fellow passengers. Joma, the young son of Henrik the Exploser, lay curled nearby, snoring softly after the excitement of leaving home for the first time. Closer to the mast sat Jop, the bristle-cheeked delegate of Dolo's farmers and crofters, peering in the half-light at a leather-bound copy of some scroll. Over by the starboard rail, Ulgor, the Urish tinker, who had spoken at the village meeting, knelt facing a Cowanish woodcarver named Blade, one of many sons of the matriarch Logbiter. Blade had lived for years among the sophisticated gray Cowans of Tarrick Town, so his choice as representative of Dolo Hive seemed natural. From a moss-lined pouch, Ulgor drew a quivering rauk symbiont of the type suited for lean Urish heads. The trembling membrane crawled over each of her triple eyes, creating the mask that reveals. Meanwhile, Blade's rauk wrapped itself around the seeing strip, bisecting his melon-like cupula. The Kewin's legs retracted, leaving only the armored claws exposed. The pair conversed in a bastard dialect of Galactic II, at best a difficult tongue for humans. Moreover, the breeze carried off the treble whistle tones, leaving just the lower track of syncopated clicks. Perhaps for those reasons, the two travelers seemed unconcerned anyone might listen. Maybe, as often happened, they underrated the reach of human hearing. Or else they're counting on something called common courtesy, she thought ironically. Lately, Sarah had become quite an eavesdropper, an unlikely habit for a normally shy, private young woman. Her recent fascination with language was the cause. This time, though, fatigue overcame curiosity. Leave them alone. You'll have plenty of chances to study dialects in Tarricktown. Sarah took her blanket over to a spot between two crates marked with Nello's seal, exuding the homey scents of Dolo's paper mill. There had been little time for rest since that frenetic town meeting. Only a few midors after adjournment, the village elders had sent a herald to wake Sarah with this assignment, to lead a delegation downriver in search of answers and guidance. She was chosen both as one with intimate knowledge of Byblos and also to represent the Dolo craft workers, as Jop would speak for the farmers and Blade for the upriver Kewins. Other envoys included Ulgor, Pizora, and Fakun, a Gekek Scriven dancer. Since each was already billeted aboard the Hafwoa, with business in Tarricktown, they could hardly refuse. Together with the ship's captain, that made at least one representative from all six exile races. A good omen, the elders hoped. Sarah still wondered about Joma. Why would Henrik dispatch the boy on a trip that promised danger, even in quiet times? "He will know what to do," the taciturn exploser had said, putting his son in Sarah's nominal care. "Once you reach Tarricktown." "If only I could say as much for myself," Sarah worried. It had been possible to turn down this assignment much as she wanted to. It's been a year since Josu died, since shame and grief made a hermit of you. Besides, who is going to care that you made a fool of yourself over a man who could never be yours? That all seems a small matter now that the world we know is coming to an end. Alone in the dark, Sarah worried. Are Dwyer and Lark safe, or has something dreadful already happened at Gathering? She felt pretty curl up alongside in her own blanket, sharing warmth. The Hoonish helmsman rumbled a crooning melody with no words in any language Sarah knew, yet conveying a sense of muzzy serenity, endlessly forbearing. "Things work out," the Hoonish umble seemed to say. Sleep finally climbed out of her body's fatigue to claim Sarah, as she thought, "I sure hope so." Later, in the middle of the night, a dream yanked her bolt upright, clutching the blanket close. Her eyes stared over the peaceful river, lit by two moons, but Sarah's heart pounded as she quailed from an awful nightmare image. Flames. Moonlight flickered on the water, and to her eyes it became fire, licking the Byblos roof of stone, blackening it with the heat and soot of a half a million burning books. The Stranger. Unconscious, he is helpless to control dark images roiling across the closed universe of his mind. It is a tight universe, narrow and confined, yet teeming with stars and confusion, with galaxies and remorse, with nebulae and pain. And water. Always water. From dense black ice fields all the way to space clouds so diffuse you might never know they thronged with beings the size of planets. Living things as slow and thin as vapor swimming through a near vacuum sea. Sometimes he thinks water will never leave him alone, nor will it let him simply die. He hears it right now, water's insistent music piercing his delirium. This time it comes to him as a soft lapping sound, the sluicing of wooden boards through gentle liquid, like some vessel bearing him along from a place he can't remember toward another whose name he'll never learn. It sounds reassuring, this melody, not like the sucking clutch of that awful swamp where he had thought he was about to drown at last, as he so nearly drowned once long ago, when the old ones forced him, screaming, into a crystal globe they then filled with a fluid that dissolved everything it touched. Or as he once fought for breath on that green, green, green world, whose thick air refused to nourish, while he stumbled on and on half-blind toward a fearsome, glimmering Jofer Tower. Or the time his body and soul felt pummeled, squeezed, unable even to gasp as he threaded a narrow passage that seemed about to strip him to his spine, before abruptly spilling him into a realm where shining light stretched on and on until his mind rebels, quailing from brief incoherent images. Fevered, he has no idea which of them are remembered, which are exaggerated, and which his damaged brain simply invented out of the pitchy stuff of nightmare. Like a starship's vapor contrail. Water. Cleaving a blue sky that reminded him of home. Or the sight of beings like himself. More water. Living on a world where they clearly don't belong. Amid the chaos of fevered hallucinations, another impression penetrates. Somehow he knows that it comes from beyond his delusion, from someplace real. It feels like a touch, a stroke of softness on his brow, a brush, accompanied by murmurs in a voice that soothes. He can make no sense of the words, but still he welcomes the sensation, even knowing that it should not be. Not here, not now. It is a comfort, that touch, making him feel just a little less alone. Eventually, it even pushes back the fearsome images, the memories and dreams. And in time, he slips from delirium into a quietude of sleep. Part 5. The Book of the Sea. When judgment comes, you will be asked about the dead. What living species, beautiful and unique, exist no more because you squatters chose a forbidden place to live? And what of your own dead? Your corpses, cadavers, and remains? Your tools and cold-made things? How have you disposed of them? Be righteous, Sooners of Jijo. Show how hard you tried. Make small the consequences of your crime, the offense of living. Felonies and their punishment can be made smaller by the simple fact of doing less harm. The Scroll of Advice. Alvin's Tale. The Mount Gwen tram climbs a steep route from Wufon Port all the way up to the workshops of Uriel the Smith. The railway is small and hard to see, even when you're looking for it. Still, it's allowed by the sages only because it's important for getting Uriel's forgings down to market. Also, it uses no artificial power. Water from a hot spring high up on the mountain pours into a tank aboard whichever car is waiting at the top station. Meanwhile, the bottom car's tank is emptied, so it's much lighter, even with passengers aboard. When the brake is cut, the heavier car starts down, pulling the cable, which in turn hauls the bottom car up. It sounds gimmicky, but in fact it goes pretty fast and can even get scary for a few seconds in the middle when the other car seems to be rushing right at you along the same set of slim wooden rails. Then you reach a split section where that car streaks past in a blur. What a thrill! It's a trip of over 40 arrow flights, but the water's still near boiling hot in the first car's tank when it reaches bottom. One reason folks like it when Uriel ships her wares down to port on laundry day. Euron says one piece of salvaged buoyer cable is what makes it all possible, a real treasure that can't ever be replaced. Mount Gwyn was behaving itself that day, so there wasn't much ash in the air and I didn't really need my cloak. Huck wore her goggles anyway, one strapped over each eyebulb, and Pincer still had to spray his red cupola as the air got thinner and Wufan turned into a toy village under its blanket of camouflage greenery. Thick stands of lowland boo soon gave way to hedgerows of multi-runked gorby trees, followed by tufts of feathery shrubs that got sparser as we climbed. This was not Red Kellen country. Still, Pincer was excited over the news from Euron.
"You see? The window's done. The last big piece we needed for the bathy. A little more work, and it'll be ready, Eddie."
Huck sniffed disdainfully. She did a good job of it, too, since that's one of those human gestures you read about that we actually get to see pretty often whenever Mr. Hines, our local schoolmaster, hears an answer he doesn't like.
"Great," Huck remarked. "Whoever rides the thing can see whatever's about to eat him."
I had to laugh. "Hurrum! So now you admit there might be sea monsters after all?" Huck swiveled three stalks toward me in a look of surprise. It's not often I can catch her like that.
"I'll admit, I'd want more than just a slab of Urish glass between me and whatever's down there 20,000 leagues under the sea."
I confess being puzzled by her attitude. This bitterness wasn't like Huck at all. I tried lightening the mood. "Say, I've always wondered, has anybody ever figured out exactly how long a league is?" Two of her eyes glazed at each other, then back at me with a glint of whimsy.
"I looked in the dictionary once, but I couldn't fathom the answer."
Pincer complained.
"Look, are you two about to start?"
I interrupted. "If anyone does know the answer, I'd sure like to meet her." Huck made a thrumming sound with her spokes.
"That's assuming you could parsec what she says."
"Hum, I don't know if I can take this furlong."
Oh.
Pincer complained, feigning agony with all five mouths at once. And that's how we passed the time while climbing into chilly badlands bare of life. And I guess it shows my dad's right about us being hummockers. But Gal 2 and Gal 6 aren't any fun for word games. You can't pun on them at all. You can in Gal 7. Well, for some reason, it just doesn't hurt as much. The mountainside got even more stark as we neared the top, where steam vents mark Mount Gwen's broad shoulders and mask the hot breath of Uriel's forges. Here some of the old volcanic spills crystallized in special ways that reflect shimmering colors, shifting as your eye moves. Only a short journey from here, the same kind of stuff stretches as far as you can see across a poison plain that's called the spectral flow. That day, my imagination was unhoonly active. I couldn't help pondering all the power bubbling away deep under the mountain. Nowhere do Jijo's innards churn more intensely than under the region we exiles call the slope. We're told that's why all the different ancestor ships planted their seed in the same part of the planet. And nowhere else on the slope do folks live in closer daily contact with that pent-up power than my hometown. No wonder we were never assigned a family of explosers to prepare our village for destruction. I guess everyone figures Wufan will be blessed by the volcano anyway, inside the next 100 years. 1,000 at most. Maybe any day now. So why bother? We're told it's proper that no trace of our homes will be left after that happens. Still, Jijo can take her own sweet time as far as I'm concerned. Despite dozens of tram trips, I still find it kind of surprising whenever the car nears the end of the climb and suddenly a great big cave seems to open out of nowhere with the rail heading straight for it. Maybe it was all that earlier talk of monsters, but this time I felt a twirl in my heart spine when that black hollow gaped wide and we plunged toward what looked an awful lot like a hungry mouth set in the face of an angry, impulsive mountain. The dark stillness inside was suddenly hot and dry as dust. Euron waited for us when the car came to a jarring halt. She seemed skittish, dancing clip-clop with all four hooves while her stubby work arms held the door, and I helped Huck roll out of the car. Little Hufu rode on pincer tips back, eyes all aglitter, as if ready for anything. Maybe the Noor was ready, but Huck, Pincer, and I were thrown completely off balance by what our Urish friend said at this point. Euron spoke in Gal 6, since it's easier for an Urs to speak without lisping.
"I am glad in my pouches that you, my friends, could come so soon. Now swiftly to Uriel's observatory, where she has for several days been tracking strange objects in the sky."
Now, I confess, I was struck dumb. Like the others, I just stared at her for several duras. Finally, we all unfroze at once.
"Hrum! You can't—"
"What do you—" "Surely you don't mean—"
Euron stamped her front left foot.
"I do mean it. Uriel and Gibbs claim to have perceived one or more starships several days ago. Moreover, when last sighted, one or all of them seemed poised to land."
Part 6. The Book of the Slope. Legends. It seems ironic that most of Jijo's nighttime constellations were named by humans, the youngest exile Sept. None of the prior six had thought of giving fanciful labels to groups of unrelated stars, associating them with real and mythical beasts. The quaint habit clearly derives from humanity's unique heritage as an orphaned race, or as self-evolved wolflings who burst into space without guidance by a patron. Every other sapient species had such a mentor, as the Hun had the Gutatsa, and Gekex had the Druli, an older, wiser species ready to teach a younger one the ropes. But not humans. This lack scarred Homo sapiens in unique ways. Countless bizarre notions bloomed among native Terran cultures during humanity's dark, lonely climb. Outlandish ideas that would never occur to an uplifted race, one taught nature's laws from the very start. Bizarre concepts, like connecting dots in the sky to form fictitious creatures. When Earthlings first did this on Jijo, the earlier groups reacted with surprise, even suspicion. but soon the practice seemed to rob the stars of some of their terror. The Gekek, Hun, and Urs started coming up with sky myths of their own, while Kewans and Treiki were glad to have tales made up about them. Since the advent of peace, scholars have disagreed in their assessment of this practice. Some say its very primitiveness helps the Six follow in the footsteps of the Glaivers. This meets with approval from those who urge that we hurry as quickly as possible down the path of redemption. Others claim it is like the trove of books in Byblos, a distraction from achieving the simple clarity of thought that will help us exiles achieve our goal. Then there are those who like the practice simply because it feels good and makes for excellent art. Cultural Patterns of the Slope by Ku Fuhaf Tuo, Ovoom Town Guild of Publishers, Year of Exile, 1922. Asks.
Who would have imagined that a robot might display surprise? Yet did we not discern an unmistakable yank, a twitch, in response to Vubbin's manifest lie? An impromptu falsehood contrived out of sudden necessity by Urja and Lester, whose quick wits do their hot-blooded tribes proud? The first scrolls, a mere 10 kilowords, engraved on polymer bars by the original Gekek pioneers, warned of several ways that doom might fall from heaven. New scrolls were added by Glaiver, Hoon, and Kewan settlers, first jealously hoarded, then shared as the commons slowly formed. Finally came human sept and its flooding gift of paper books. But even the great printing could not cover all potentialities. Among likely prospects, it was thought the galactic institutes charged with enforcing quarantine might some day find us, or titanic cruisers of the great patron clans would descry our violation, if, when the glaring eye Ismanuti ceased spewing its wind of masking needles. Among other possibilities, we pondered what to do if a great globe ship of the hydrogen-breathing Zang came to one of our towns, dripping freezing vapors in wrath over our trespass. These and many other contingencies we discussed, did we not, my rings? But seldom this thing, which had come to pass, the arrival of desperadoes. If malefactors ever did come to Jijo, we reasoned, why should they make themselves known to us? With a world to sieve for riches, would they even deign to notice the hovels of a few coarse savages, far devolved from ancient glory, clumped in one small corner of Jijo's expanse? Yet here they have come into our midst with a boldness that terrifies. The robot emissary contemplated Vubbin's proclamation for 10 duras, then responded with a single terse interrogation. Your presence on this world, it is a query accident? Do you recall, my rings, the brief thrill that coursed our linking membranes? The robot's masters were set aback. against all reason or proportionality of force. The initiative was ours for a moment.
Vubbin crossed two eye stalks in a gesture of polite aloofness.
Your question, it insinuates doubt. More than doubt, it suggests grave assumptions about our nature. Those assumptions, might they lay upon our ancestors' necks a shackling suspicion? Query, suspicion of heinous crimes?
How resilient was Vubbin's misdirection! How like the web of a mulk spider! He denies nothing, tells no explicit lie. Yet how he implies! Forgiveness for unintended insults we implore, the machine ratcheted hastily. Descendants of castaways we take you for, an ill-fated vessel your ancestors' combined ship must have been. Lost on some noble errand, this we scarcely doubt. Now, they were the liars. Of that we had no doubt at all.
Dwer. Leaving the craggy Rimmer Range, Dwer led Reddy and the others into that region of undulating hills, gently slanting toward the sea, that was called the Slope. The domain of the Six. Dwer tried getting his mysterious young prisoner to talk about herself, but his first efforts were answered in morose monosyllables. Clearly, Reddy resented the fact that he could tell so much from her appearance, her animal skin clothes, her speech and manner.
"Well, what did you expect? To sneak over the mountains and walk into one of our villages, no questions asked?"
Her burn scar alone would mark her for attention. Not that disfigurement was rare on the Slope. Accidents were common, and even the latest Traiki unguents were crude medicine by galactic standards. Still, people would notice Reddy anywhere she went. At meals, she gaped covetously at the goods he drew from his backpack, his cup and plate, the hammered aluminum skillet, his bedroll of fleecy hirchin down, things to make life a bit easier for those whose ancestors long ago forsook the life of star gods. To Dwer, there was a simple beauty in the woven cloth he wore, in boots with shape-treated tree-sap soles, even the elegant three-piece Urish fire starter, all examples of primitive cunning, the sort his wolfling ancestors relied on through their lonely isolation on old Earth. Most people took such things for granted on the Slope. But to a clan of Sooners, illegal squatters living jealous and filthy beyond the pale, they might seem marvels worth any risk to steal. Dwer wondered, was this the only time? Perhaps Reddy was just the first to get caught. Some thefts blamed on Noors might be the fault of other robbers sneaking over the mountains from a far-off hermit tribe.
Was that your idea? To swipe the first worthwhile thing you came across and scoot home to your tribe, a hero?
Somehow, he figured more than that must be involved. She kept peering around, as if looking for something in particular, something that mattered to her.
Dwer watched Reddy lead the captive Glaiver by a rope tied to her waist. The girl's saucy gait seemed meant to defy him, or anyone else who might judge her. Between clumps of grimy hair, he was nauseated to see puckered traps made by borer bees,
a parasite easily warded off with Treiki salve. But no Treikis lived where she came from. It forced uncomfortable thoughts. What if his own grandparents had made the same choice as Reddy's? To flee the commons, for whatever reason, seeking far reaches to hide in. Nowadays, with war and war's refugees a thing of the past, Sooners were rather rare. Old Fallon had found only one squatter band in many years roaming across half a continent, and this was Dwyer's first encounter. What would you do if you were raised that way? Scraping for a living like animals, knowing a land of wealth and power lay beyond those mountains to the west. Dwyer had never thought of the slope that way before. Most scrolls and legends emphasized how far the six exile races had already fallen, not how much farther there was yet to go. That night, Dwyer used Tobar seeds to call another Klokteet, not because he wanted an early wake-up, but to have the steady tapping rhythm in the background while he slept. When Mudfoot yowled at the burst of aroma covering his snout, Reddy let out a soft giggle and her first smile. He insisted on examining her feet before bed, and she quietly let him treat two blisters, showing early signs of infection. "We'll have healers look you over when we reach gathering," he told her. Neither of them commented when he kept her moccasins, tucking them under his sleeping roll for the night. As they lay under a starry canopy, separated by the dim campfire coals, he urged Reddy to name a few constellations, and her curt answers helped Dwyer eliminate one momentous possibility, that some new group of human exiles had landed, destroying their ship and settling to brute existence far from the slope. Reddy couldn't realize the importance of naming a few patterns in the sky, but Dwyer erased one more pinprick of worry. The legends were the same. At dawn, Dwyer awoke, sniffing something in the air, a familiar odor, almost pleasant, but also nervous. A sensation Lark once explained mysteriously as negative ions and water vapor. Dwyer shook Reddy awake and hurriedly led the glaiver under a rocky overhang. Mudfoot followed, moving like an arthritic gekek, grumbling hatred of mornings with every step. They all made it to shelter just as a sheet storm hit, an undulating curtain of continuous rain that crept along the mountainside from left to right, pouring water like a translucent drapery that pummeled everything beneath, soaking the forest one wavy ribbon at a time. Reddy stared wide-eyed as the rainbow-colored tapestry swept by, drenching their campsite and ripping half the leaves off trees. Obviously, she had never witnessed one before. The trek resumed. Perhaps it was a night's restful sleep or the eye-opening start to the day, but Reddy now seemed less sullen, more willing to enjoy sights like a meadow full of bumble flowers, yellow tubes fringed with black fuzz, which rode the steady west wind, swooping and buzzing at the end of tether stems. Reddy's eyes darted, enthralled by the antic dance of deception and pollination. The species did not exist in the stagnant weather shadow beyond the rimmers, where a vast plain of poison grass stretched most of the way to the gray hills. "Just getting here across all that was an accomplishment," Dwyer noted, wondering how she had managed it. As alpine sheerness gave way to gentler foothills, Reddy gave up hiding her fierce curiosity. She began by pointing and asking, "Are those wooden poles holding up your backpack? Don't they make it heavy?
I'll bet they're hollow. Then, if you're a hunter, where's the rest of your stalking gang? Or do you always hunt alone?
In rapid succession, more questions followed. Who made your bow? How far can you hit something the size of my hand? Did you live in one place the whole time you were little? In a house? Did you get to hold on to stuff you wanted to keep instead of leaving it behind when you moved? If you grew up by a river, did you ever see any hoon? What are they like? I hear they're tall as a tree with nose as long as your arm. Are the tricky really tricky? Are they made of tree sap? Do they eat garbage? Do gnores ever slow down? I wonder why Booyer made them that way.
Other than her habit of turning Booyer into a singular proper name, Dwyer couldn't have phrased the last question any better himself. Mudfoot was a perpetual nuisance, getting underfoot, chasing shrub critters, then lying in ambush somewhere along the path, squeaking in delight when Dwyer failed to pick him out of the overhanging foliage. "I could shake you easily if I didn't have a glaiver and a kid in tow," Dwyer thought at the grinning Noor. Yet he was starting to feel pretty good. They would make quite an entrance at gathering, sure to be the talk of the festival. Over lunch, Reddy used his cooking knife to prepare a scrub hen he had shot. Dwyer could barely follow her whirling hands as the good parts landed in the skillet with a crackling sizzle, while the poison glands flew to the waste pit. She finished, wiping the knife with a flourish, and offered it back to him. "Keep it," Dwyer said, and she responded with a hesitant smile. With that, he ceased being her jailer and became her guide, escorting a prodigal daughter back to the embrace of clan and commons. Or so he thought, until some time later during the meal when she said, "I really have seen some of those before."
"Seen some of what?"
Reddy pointed at the glaiver, placidly chewing under the shade of a stand of swaying lesser boo.
"You thought I never saw any 'cause I feared she'd bite, but I seen 'em from afar. A whole herd, sneaky devils, hard to catch, took the guys all day to spearin'. They taste awful gamey, but the boys liked it fine."
Dwyer swallowed hard.
"Are you saying your tribe hunts and eats glaivers?"
Reddy looked back with brown eyes full of innocent curiosity.
"You don't on this side? I'm not surprised. There's easier prey and better eaten."
He shook his head, nauseated by the news. Part of him chided, "You were willing to shoot this particular glaiver down stone dead if it crossed over the pass."
"Yes, but only as a last resort, and I wouldn't eat her."
Dwyer knew what people called him, the wild man of the forest, living beyond the law. He even helped nurse the mystique, since it meant his awkward speech was taken for something more manly than shyness. In truth, killing was the part of any hunt he did as capably and swiftly as possible, never with enjoyment. Now, to learn people beyond the mountains were devouring glaivers? The sages would be appalled. Ever since surmising that Reddy came from a Sooner band, Dwyer had known his duty would be to guide a militia expedition to round up the errant clan. Ideally, it would be a simple matter of firm but gentle ingathering, resettling lost cousins back into the fold of the commons. But now Reddy had unknowingly indicted her tribe with another crime. The scrolls were clear. "That which is rare, you shall not eat. That which is precious, you must protect. But above all, you may not devour what once flew between the stars." Irony was ashen in Dwyer's mouth.
for after the Sooners were brought back for trial, his job would be to collect every Glaver living east of the Rimmers and slaughter those he could not catch.
Ah, but that won't make me a bad person, because I won't eat them.
Reddy must have sensed his reaction. She turned to stare at the nearby stand of Great Boo, its young shoots barely as thick as her waist. The tube-like green shafts swayed in rippling waves, like fur on the belly of the lazy Noor dozing by her foot.
"Are they going to hang me?"
the girl asked quietly. The scar on her face, which was muted when she smiled, now seemed stretched and livid.
"Old Clin says you Slopies hang Sooners when you catch 'em."
"Nonsense. Actually, each race handles its own.
The old folks say it's Slopy law. Kill anyone who tries to make a free life east of the Rimmers."
Dwyer stammered, suddenly awash in irritation.
If you think that, why'd you come all this way? To stick your head in a noose?"
Reddy's lips pressed. She looked away and murmured low,
"You wouldn't believe me."
Dwyer repented his own flash of temper. In a gentler tone, he asked, "Why don't you try me? Maybe I might understand better than you think." But she withdrew once more into a cocoon of brooding silence, unresponsive as a stone. While Dwyer hastily rinsed the cooking gear, Reddy tied herself in place ahead of the Glaver, even though he had said she could walk free. He found his cooking knife by the smothered coals, where she must have laid it after those sharp words. The gesture of rejection irked him, and he muttered gruffly, "Let's get out of here." Asks.
We had chosen to feign a small distinction between two crimes, at best a slightly lesser felony, that of accidental rather than planned colonization. No one could deny the obvious, that our ancestors had loosed unsanctioned offspring on a fallow world. But Vubbin's artful evasion implied an act of culpable carelessness, rather than villainy by design. The lie would not hold for long. When archaeological traces were sifted, forensic detectives from the institutes would swiftly perceive our descent from many separate landings, not one mixed crew stranded by mishap on this remote shore. Moreover, there was the presence of our junior-most sept, the human clan. By their own bizarre tale, they are a wolfling race, unknown to galactic culture until just 300 Jijoan years ago. Then, why even try such a bluff? Desperation, plus a frail hope that our guests have not the skill or tools for archaeology. Their goal must be to swoop in for a quick sampling of hidden treasures. Then, covering their tracks, they would wish a swift, stealthy departure with a ship's hold full of contraband. To this mercenary quest, our strange, forlorn colony of miscreants offers both opportunity and a threat. They must know we possess first-hand knowledge of Jijo, valuable to their needs. Alas, my rings, are we not also potential witnesses to their villainy?
Sarah. Nobody expected an ambush. It was the perfect place for one. Still, no one aboard the Haufoa had any idea of danger until it actually happened. A century of peace had blurred the once jealously guarded domains of old. Urish and Gekek settlers were few, since the former could not raise young near water, and the latter preferred smooth terrain. Still, all types were seen crowding tiny docks when the Haufoa glided by, eager to share scant news. Alas, there had been none from downstream since that terrible spectacle crossed the sky. Mostly the river folk were reacting constructively, rushing to reinforce their facade screens, cleaning the baffles of their smokestacks, or hauling boats under cover. But one forlorn tribe of Treiki marsh dwellers had gone much further, burning their entire stilt village in a spasm of fear and fealty to the scrolls. Pizora's topknot shivered at the aroma of woe-begone ringstacks floundering in the ashes. The Haufoa's captain promised to spread word of their plight. Perhaps other Treiki would send new basal segments for the locals to wear, making them better suited for evacuation inland. At worst, the swamp Treiki could gather rotting matter, settle on top, and shut down higher functions till the world became a less scary place. The same could not be said for an Urish trade caravan they passed later, stranded with their pack beasts on the desolate west bank, when the panicky citizens of the Bing village blew up their beloved bridge. The Hunish boat crew backpedaled with frantic haste, rowing against the current to avoid getting caught in a tangle of broken timbers and mulk fiber cables, shattered remnants of a beautiful span that had been the chief traverse for an entire region. A marvel of clever camouflage, the bridge used to resemble a jagged snag of jumbled logs, but even that apparently wasn't enough for local Orthodox scroll thumpers. Maybe they were burning it while I had my nightmare last night, Sarah thought, observing charred timbers and recalling images of flame that had torn her sleep. A crowd of villagers stood on the east bank, beckoning the Haufoa to draw near. Blade spoke up.
I would not approach,
the blue Kewin hissed from several leg vents. He wore a rauk over his vision ring while peering at the folk on shore.
And why not? Jop demanded. See? They're pointing to a way past the debris. Perhaps they have news as well.
Sure enough, there did appear to be a channel near the shore, unobstructed by remnants of the broken bridge.
I don't know, Blade went on. I sense that something is wrong.
You're right about that, Ulger added. I'd like to know why they have done nothing for the stranded caravan. The villagers have votes. The Urs could have been ferried across by now.
Sarah wondered. It certainly would not be fun for any of Ulgor's race to ride a little coracle with icy water lapping just an arm's breadth away. The Urs may have refused, she suggested. Perhaps they're not that desperate yet. The captain made his decision, and the Haufoa turned toward the village. As they drew near, Sarah saw that the only construct still intact was the hamlet's camouflage lattice. Everything else lay in ruins. They've probably sent their families into the forest, she thought. There were plenty of garu trees for humans to live in, and Kewanish citizens could join cousins upstream. Still, the toppled village was a depressing sight. Sarah pondered how much worse things might be if Jop ever got his wish. If Dolo Dam blew up, every dock, weir, and cabin they had seen below the floodline would be swept away. Native creatures would also suffer, though perhaps no more than in a natural flood. Lark says it is species that matter, not individuals. No eco-niches would be threatened by demolishing our small wooden structures. Jijo wouldn't be harmed. Still, it seems dubious. All of this burning and wrecking just to persuade some galactic big shots we're farther along the path of redemption than we really are. Blade sidled alongside, his blue carapace, steaming dew, evaporated from the seams of his shell, a sure sign of anxiety. He rocked a complex rhythm among his five chitinous legs.
"Sarah, do you have a rauk? Can you put it on and see if I'm mistaken?"
"Sorry, I gave mine up. All those colors and raw emotions get in the way of paying close attention to language." She did not add that it had grown painful to wear the things ever since she made the mistake of using one at Joe Shu's funeral. "Why?" she asked. "What's got you worried?" Blade's cupola trembled, and the rauk that was wrapped around it quivered.
"The people on shore, they seem strange somehow."
Sarah peered through the morning haze. The Bing villagers were mostly human, but there were also Hoon, Traiki, and Kewans in the mix. Likes attract, she thought. Orthodox fanaticism crossed racial lines. As does heresy, Sarah noted, recalling that her own brother was part of a movement no less radical than the folk who had brought down this bridge. Several coracles set forth from tree-shrouded shelters aiming to intercept the riverboat.
"Are they coming to pilot us through?" young Joma asked.
He got his answer when the first grappling hook whistled, then fell to the deck on the haupwoa. Others swiftly followed.
"We mean you no harm,"
shouted a thick-armed man in the nearest skiff.
"Come ashore and we'll take care of you. All we want is your boat."
That was the wrong thing to say to the proud crew of a river runner. Every Hoon but the helmsman ran to seize and toss overboard the offending hooks. But more grapplers sailed aboard for every one they removed. Then Joma pointed downstream.
"Look!"
If anyone still wondered what the Bingites planned for the haupwoa, all doubts vanished at the sight of a charred ruin, blackened ribs spearing upward like a huge, half-burned skeleton. It triggered an umble of dismay from the crew, resonating down Sarah's spine and sending the newer beasts into frenzied fits of barking. The Hoon redoubled their efforts, tearing frantically at the hooks. Sarah's first instinct was to shield the stranger, but the wounded man seemed safe, still unconscious under Pizora's protecting bulk.
"Come on," she told Blade. "We better help."
Pirates often used to attack ships this way until the Great Peace. Perhaps the attacker's own ancestors used the technique in deadly earnest during the bad old days. The grapples, made of pointy buoyer metal, dug deep when the cables tautened. Sarah realized in dismay that the cords were mulk fiber, treated by a Traiki process that made them damnably hard to cut. Worse, the line stretched not just to the coracles, but all the way to shore, where locals hauled them taut with blocks and tackle. Hoon strength, helped by Blade's great claws, barely sufficed to wrestle the hooks free. Still, Sarah tried to help, and even the Gekek passenger kept lookout with four keen eyes, shouting to warn when another boat crew drew near. Only Jop leaned against the mast, watching with clear amusement. Sarah had no doubt who the Orthodox tree farmer was rooting for.
The beach loomed ever closer. If the Haupo'a made it past midpoint, she'd have the river's pull on her side. But even that force might be too little to break the strong cords. When the keel scraped sand, it would spell the end. In desperation, the crew hit on a new tactic. Taking up axes, they chopped away at planks and rails, wherever a grapple had dug in, tearing out whole wooden chunks to throw overboard, attacking their own vessel with a fury that was dazzling to behold, given normal Hoon placidity. Then all at once the deck jerked under Sarah's feet as the whole boat suddenly shuddered, slewing, as if the center mast were a pivot.
"They've hooked the rudder!" someone cried.
Sarah looked over the stern and saw a massive metal barb speared through the great hinged paddle the helmsman used to steer the ship. The rudder could not be pulled aboard or chopped loose without crippling the Haupo'a, leaving it adrift and helpless. Pretty bared her teeth and screamed. Though shivering with fear, the little ape started climbing over the rail till Sarah stopped her with a firm hand. "It's my job," she said tersely, and without pause shrugged out of her tunic and kilt. A sailor handed her a hatchet with a strap thong through the haft. "Don't everybody speak up all at once to argue me out of doing this," she thought sardonically, knowing no one would. Some things were simply obvious. The hatchet hung over one shoulder. It wasn't comforting to feel its metal coolness stroke her left breast as she climbed, even though the cutting edge still bore a leather cover. Clothes would have been an impediment. Sarah needed her toes, especially to seek footholds on the Haupo'a's stern. The clinker construction style left overlaps in the boards that helped a bit. Still, she could not prevent shivering, half from the morning chill and partly from stark terror. Sweaty palms made it doubly hard, even though her mouth felt dry as Irish breath. "I haven't done any climbing in years." To non-humans, this must look like another day's work for a tree-hugging earthling, kind of like expecting every Urz to be a courier runner, or all Treikis to make a good martini. In fact, Jop was the logical one for this task, but the captain didn't trust the man, with good reason. The crew shouted tense encouragement as she clambered down the stern, holding the rudder with one arm. Meanwhile, derisive scorn came from the coracles and those ashore. "Great, more attention than I ever had in my life, and I'm stark naked at the time." The mult cable groaned with tension as villagers strained on pulleys to haul Haupo'a toward the beach, where several gray Kewans gathered, holding torches that loomed so frighteningly close that Sarah imagined she could hear the flames. At last she reached a place where she could plant her feet and hands, bracing her legs in a way that forever surrendered all illusions of personal modesty. She had to tear the leather cover off the axe with her teeth and got a bitter electrical taste from the reddish metal. It made her shudder, then tense up as she almost lost her grip. The boat's churning wake looked oily and bitter cold. Jeers swelled as she hacked at the rudder blade, sending chips flying, trying to cut a crescent around the embedded hook. She soon finished gouging away above the grapple and was starting on the tougher part below when something smacked the back of her left hand, sending waves of pain throbbing up her arm. She saw blood ooze around a wooden sliver protruding near the wrist. A slingshot pellet lay buried halfway in the plank nearby. Another glanced off the rudder, ricocheting from the boat's stern, then skipping across the water. Someone was shooting at her. "Why, you jeeky, slucking, devoluted—" Sarah found an unknown aptitude for cursing as she went through a wide vocabulary of oaths from five different languages,
hacking away with the hatchet more vehemently than ever. A steady drumbeat of pebbles now clattered against the hull, but she ignored them in a blur of heat and fury.
"Atsjar Saya Parkaya Sukaya Drisuna!"
She ran out of obscenities in Rossic and was starting to plumb Urish Gal, too, when the plank abruptly let out a loud crack. The attached cable moaned, yanking hard at the grappling hook, and the tortured wood gave way. The hook snatched the axe out of her hand as it tore free, glittering in the sunlight.